Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast. I'm Eric Quanstrom, the CMO at Cyence.
And I'm Caroline Maloney. I am the Director of Sales Training and Enablement at Cyence.
Woohoo! Got another great, awesome, kick-ass author on the pod today. And that's Andy Paul. His new book is out now. It's called Sell Without Selling Out. It's fabulous. I've read it. I've left my own Amazon 5-star review. And, you know, I think Andy, not only has he been kind of a multi-time author, leading sales training and consultant, he's the host of the Sales Enablement Podcast, which now has over 1,000 episodes. So we turned the tables on him and we got him on our podcast, and he revealed a lot of really great stuff.
Yeah. You know, Eric, he teases out something that he goes into in the book about the four pillars. I'm not even going to talk about what that is because you got to listen to the podcast, but it's some really brilliant stuff. He is a master of this craft.
Yeah, and he also keeps it real too. You know, like we talked a bit about some of the things that salespeople do that are just like, they don't advance the sale, to put it mildly.
Yeah, he talks about the connotations, you know, the negative connotations that a lot of people have with salespeople. He breaks down why people have those, you know, perceptions of sales folks and what we can do to redirect sales, lead with honesty and empathy. He goes into why first impressions matter too. Probably my favorite part of the podcast.
Without a doubt. So chock full of insights. You're going to take a ton away from this episode. So without further ado, and by the way, you're going to also stop doing a bunch of things if you're doing them the wrong way. And that may be the best reason to listen to this podcast. So enjoy. I think the place to start, obviously, this time is with your new book, you know, Sell Without Selling Out. Mm-hmm. By Andy Paul. You know, we're on with Andy Paul, which is so exciting. And we were just joking kind of like pre-show around, you know, this is a very candid book on some of the techniques that you should just abandon and never even have as part of your sales routine, sales motion. You know, being salesy is actually a dirty word, and I'm glad that you called it out.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I thought we could draw a line in the sand, right? And say, look, starting today, effective today, all these sales-centric, salesy behaviors that buyers resist and buyers, quite frankly, hate, we could all stop doing them today. Today, everybody, every salesperson in the world could just stop them today and no one would be worse off for it. And isn't that the sign that it's time? Yeah. So that it's, you know, I just don't get it. And I know that we continue to sort of train people and socialize. It's a combination of training and socializing sellers for what their job is that sort of perpetuate it. But the other part, though, is this idea, and I've heard this on some podcast interviews I've been guests on recently, is those saying, well, yeah, great book, but I'm just thinking about those salespeople. You know, they've got a number to meet, right? You've got a number to meet. Thus, you must be salesy. And it's like, no, that's 180 degrees. It's why they're having so much trouble hitting their number is because they're selling out and they're putting the customer into an uncomfortable position where you're not helping them make the decision. You're actually taking more time to make it happen as opposed to less time. So again, that's another perspective that somehow, yeah, it's all great, but when push comes to shove, we have to act salesy, and that's just BS.
Yeah. And so do you think it comes from a place of pure desperation that we resort to these salesy tactics? Or do you think, because, you know, for me, I think when I think about salesy or commission breath or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. however you want to call it, I think about best practices and people just relying on these best practices that totally are not best.
Best practice. Yes. Well, and yeah. So yeah, I think you have to look at sort of the bigger picture, right? So let's say in the SaaS world, and not to pick on the SaaS world, if they people follow me around, they probably think I'm picking on it, but I'm not. But it's very typical that, you know, win rates on your most qualified opportunities sort of in that 20 to 30% range. I was talking to the CEO of a SaaS company yesterday, moderately successful company, and he's saying, yeah, we're really good. I said, oh yeah, what's win rate? Oh, 30%. It's like, see, I think that's not good. And in fact, I would say that, you know, if you are only winning 20 to 30% of your most qualified opportunities, you have to ask yourself, one of two things is at play. Either we don't have product market fit, because it's hard to say you do if you're winning such a low fraction of your qualified opportunities, or we're just not very good at selling. And it's going to be one of those two things or some combination thereof.
Ooh, and how much of that do you think is on marketing? And how much of that do you think is on sales training?
Well, I think since Eric's listening, it's all on. But well, it's not really on anybody. It's just sort of you have to look at the process in total. And you know, we've gotten really good at top of funnel activities in general, right? Is we know how to create a lot of stuff at the top of the funnel. But what's happened is I think a lot of companies sort of gotten a little bit lazy when it comes to the sales side. And they say, look, we know if we just do an okay job on the things that are flowing past us, we'll win a certain percentage of them. And in some companies, selling has really become playing the odds. Put enough in the top, yeah, I'll get some. I don't really have to be that good at it. And my thought is, well, if you're investing all that money to bring in these opportunities, then why not be good at it? You know, why not, instead of saying, look, our growth path next year is, yeah, we're going to grow 20%. So we're going to make sure we get, you know, 20 to 30% more opportunities on top of the funnel, and we'll win proportionally more of them. I said, why would you do that? Why don't you learn how to really sell it? Let's learn how, instead of selling, closing 20%, next year, let's close 30%. The year after, we'll go 40. And I guarantee you, we'll sell more with the same number of people. It'll be hugely more profitable, and we'll grow just as fast. So why don't we do that instead? But it's just not part of the playbook that people sort of execute these days.
Which is surprising if you look at things holistically, because there's a customer acquisition cost or a CAC for mm-hmm. every lead that you bring kind of through the door, whether it's inbound or outbound. And that cost is largely amortized across every hand raiser, every lead that, you know, is passed to sales, no mm-hmm. matter what, no matter how many of them are closed.
Right. Yeah. So first of all, sales has to be more discriminating at the top and ensure that fewer of those opportunities make their way in front of the account executives, or the account executives have to be more diligent to make sure they're scrubbing that shit out of their pipeline. Sorry, I didn't mean to slip. I get passionate about this.
No, I love it. Keep it coming.
Because you have to be mindful of the fact that you have a limited amount of time. And I mean, part of this goes back to this sort of vicious cycle, right? Is managers think, look, I don't have the confidence that we're going to close enough opportunities. Therefore, I'm going to require you to work more opportunities every month. You have this, you know, cover your pipeline coverage. Be 5x your number, 7x. And somebody told me about a company recently, it was like 11x just in the last couple weeks. I was like, oh my goodness. Is as a sales leader, you have to think about is, you know, your win rate is going to be the reciprocal of your pipeline coverage. So why do you want people to work more opportunities? If you're afraid they're not going to close enough, the solution is to have them work on fewer and do a better job. And you, as the sales leader and sales manager, help them learn how to do a better job, not to say, let's expose them to more opportunities that we do a bad job on and we don't win. And there's some prominent voices in the investment community and so on say, yeah, just forget win rate. It's all about deal flow past the sellers. And I just think, that's complete BS.
At the risk of giving too much away of the book, you kind of lay out some strategies for how to reverse that cycle. I'd love if you could touch on some of them here.
Which ones did you have in mind?
Well, I think that, you know, the curiosity aspect is probably where I would lead and start, you know,
yeah.
what a sales cycle actually should be, how you should represent for your buyer.
Right. If selling out is being salesy, selling in is what your buyers need from you. Right. If you want to create these, at heart, the book is really about how do you create positive buying experiences? Because in these days, and not just true of tech products, true products and all sorts of different spectrums, is the difference between the products are so slight and so slim, especially in the mind's eye of the buyer. What's the point of differentiation? Oftentimes it's you, the seller, right? Challenger talked about this, Gartner's talked about Forrester. It's in the buyer's decision making, they'll attribute the majority of the factors that they consider to this experience with the individual seller. Well, if that's the case, then let's start there, right? Is, yeah, if we're telling sellers their job is to go out and persuade a buyer to buy their product, then you're going to default to the salesy behaviors that buyers resist. If instead we say, look, we're going to socialize you to understand your job as a seller is to go out, first of all, listen to your buyer, understand what's the most important things to them, both the challenges they face and the outcomes they're trying to achieve, and then help them get that. Well, that's going to lead to a whole different set of behaviors. And so I describe those as selling in and four pillars of selling in, which are connection, curiosity, understanding, and generosity. And it starts with your ability to connect with someone as a human being and to be interested in them, right? What's important to them? Just start from that perspective. And if you start doing that, then you open the door to building some credibility with them and a level of trust with them. This trust becomes important as you then move into curiosity because, as I write about in the book, you're basically trying to earn the right to stick your nose into the buyer's business. I mean, if they're just going to give you superficial answers to the questions you ask because you've asked your rote discovery questions, just like every other salesperson, then you get those rote answers. You'll never get to the point of understanding what's really most important to them. You know, you'll know something about their business, but you won't understand the context of that and why it's important. So trust really becomes important then to open the doors to a deeper level of discovery, to really get to the heart of what's important to the buyer and who it's most important to.
I love this. This reminds me a lot about, you know, people's misconception with relationship building with prospects, mm-hmm. because the goal is not necessarily to become good friends with prospects, no. right? Like you don't need to become friends, go out to dinner, hang out, but you know, to build that familiarity, to build that trust, you know, is absolutely integral to yeah. your communication with your prospects, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, there's this misconception about relationships and sales. And to some people, it can only mean friendship or can only mean wining and dining prospects. Now, my career, even before I started my consulting company 20 years ago, sold two-thirds of $1 billion worth of hardware and services to companies all around the world, big major enterprises as well as small companies. I think I went to dinner maybe 6 times with buyers, played golf twice. I mean, they didn't want to do it back then. I mean, sure, there's some fields. Yeah, let's do that type thing. You didn't have to.
Advertising sales.
Yeah, advertising sales, exactly. It wasn't really even desirable on everybody's part, right? People had jobs, they wanted to go home. So yeah, it's not about becoming friends. It does help to be friendly. Some people think, I even think that's controversial. I think, oh, you don't need to be friendly with the buyers. Like, well, we're talking about something where the degree of difference between you and someone else could be so slight, right? I say, you know, ask the question. I talk to groups and do workshops and so on. I say, somebody raise their hand. Tell me, how much did you win your last deal by? What was your margin of victory? They're like, you mean price? I said, no. How much did you win by? You know, were you 10% better? 15% better? Well, what dimensions? So I said, overall, right? We can't judge that, right? You just assume that you have to be just 1% better than the other person. So what's it cost you to be friendly? Anything? Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's so few things that we control in sales. Being friendly is one of them. And Cialdini wrote about in his book, Persuasion, that yeah, buyers are more likely to do business with people they think like them.
Yeah.
So it doesn't hurt. So it's just one of these things where like people just got to get out of their own heads about this. Is just act like a normal human being. And one of the best ways to form a connection with another human being is, and this is something that, again, I think is humorous because I made a career bringing people from engineering into sales. And I always had people say, oh, engineers don't have the people skills. And it's like, what people skills? Because all the friends you don't, the only people skill you need is really to say, can you make a friend? I mean, you're not trying to make the buyer a friend, but the same motion you go through to make a friend is how you connect with another human being, right? If I meet you in a social setting, yeah, the first thing out of my mouth is not going to be, let me tell you all about me, right? Let me pitch you on me, right? Who does that? No one does that, right? Or can I get your email so I can put you on my friend funnel list? You know, it's like, you just don't do that. You ask a question, you know, where'd you live before you moved here? You know, how old are your kids? I mean, just spend a few minutes on that. Just be a human. It works.
Such wise wisdom that comes in simple packages is unfortunately not always well heeded.
No, it's because people want to make it more complicated. I mean, this whole notion that people don't have time for small talk, which I address in the book, is just a fallacy. It's outright wrong. There's been books after books after books written about small talk that says this is a fundamental building block of building a relationship with a person or a connection with a person. Just a little small talk. You have to spend half an hour on it or 20 minutes on it. In fact, in the book, I address head on this whole thing that everybody, you know, don't talk about the weather.
Talk about the weather.
Actually, I think the weather is actually a great thing to talk about because it's something that we have in common. We both experience weather.
Yeah.
It depends how we ask about it. You know, if I ask about, you know, hey, how's the weather? Eh, no one cares. But if I did a little research, which I always do, when I call somebody, I'm interested to sort of what's going on. You know, if you're in Boston, there's a big storm, Caroline. It's like, yeah, I got to hear you're really getting hammered by that storm. You know, it's a snow day, right? And then, yeah, you can go into it. Hey, I had snow days as a kid. I want to talk about what I like doing as a snow day. I mean, it's just, you spend a few minutes on it and you start connected and create this little bond. It's part of the way humans operate. Mm. And we haven't repealed, you know, the way humans operate just because we have the internet.
Yeah.
Arguably, it's more important, especially in distributed, remote, always on Zoom type of, you know, frankly, work places now. I think the humanity is probably, I would even argue, I don't know how you could tease or measure this or survey this out, but I've already started to see analyst firms with the murmurs of, you know, human to human, like works better.
Well, yeah, I got a big kick. So like in the first few months of the pandemic is there's all these articles about, oh, you have to lead with empathy. I'm like, does someone think that's new? I mean, right? Where is that new? I mean, it's like suddenly somebody discovered empathy. It's like, yeah, we've always had to lead with empathy.
Well, if we want to do it right. And I think that one of the things, I don't recall if you use this word in the book, but one of the ways that I've always equated salesy is transactional.
Yes.
Whenever I feel like, you know, there's a sales situation that feels transactional to me, that's what people recoil from. That's where humanity's been stripped out of the process. That's sure. Where, you know, you might make the argument that like, that's what's pushing everyone, you know, make your number, right? Like that's transactional thinking.
Very.
At its...
And happens every month. Right? You send your salespeople, your account executives out in the field, literally or figuratively, and they connect to the buyer and said, yeah, we're here to help you solve this problem you have. We're here to help. Until the last week of the month. And then it's, actually, we're here to get an order. And what, you know, it's the equivalent of, what do I got to do to get you in this car today? Right? Yeah. What do I got to do to get you to sign the contract this week? And you've revealed your true colors. Yeah, you're not there to help. You're just purely transactional. And you know what? We may see, you offer a big enough discount. I may still do business with you, but I'm going to churn.
Yeah. It's that scarcity mindset. You always get that. The final few days of the month, you always get that, hey, just checking in email, right? You know, yeah. Did you get my emails?
Yeah, I know you said you didn't want close till next month, but, you know.
Just circling back.
Those of us on the buy side who really like deals and like discounts, we know the windows in which to buy from.
Right. And so what you do have to do as a company, and I've done this with companies where I've run divisions and so on, is we just said, no, we're not doing that anymore. We'll get business the right way. Mm-hmm. And oh, wow, we grew really fast when we did that. It's like you train your customers to expect those things. You know, you train them to expect this behavior and then you live up to that expectation. And it doesn't have to happen that way. Yeah, I sat in and there's some small conferences going on once and they had 10 tables in there and sales leaders discussing various topics. And I started rotating from table to table. And one of them was like the use of discounts and spiffs to close deals. And they're talking about, this is what we do the last week of the month to get people close deals. And so I just posed the question to everybody. I said, so you ever done an ROI calculation on that spiff? So, giving away 3 to 5 margin points, 3 to 5 margin points to bring the deal in from Monday to Friday, did that pay off for you? And it's like, just like blank stares. It's like, well, no, this is just what we do. Well, hey, think about it. Just don't do it. And get the deal on Monday if that's what it takes. Oh, but we won't hit our numbers. It's like, you hit the number on the year. Big deal.
So true.
It sounds like you might have some thoughts around how organizations can set up their comp structures or, metrics.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you want my latest idea?
Yes, please.
This is my latest crazy idea. Actually, I don't think it's so crazy. So I think sales leaders that a significant percentage of their comp, their variable compensation, should be based on the number of their sellers that hit their quota. So you get, just say $5,000 for every seller that hits their quota on the year. Because right now, we all read the reports, less than fewer than 50% of reps are hitting quota. If you tie leadership incentives to quota attainment, then they'll stop this bullshit about how they set quotas and set them in a way that people actually can attain them. And then if you do that, what you do is you start creating a virtuous cycle with your sellers that get this confidence that, I'm hitting my number. Hey, maybe give me a little bit more next year. I'll hit that, right? Because I can earn more money. Instead, most of them are so far underwater that hope is just an illusion. So think about it from a quality control aspect. If you're a sales leader and you've got fewer than 50% of your sellers hitting their numbers, what are you doing? Where's your quality control? What's the quality of the product you, the sales leader, are responsible for putting out in the field is bad, right? So fix it.
There's an interesting proxy there, and I like extending that idea over to the sales development realm as well, right? Like if SDR managers or SDR leaders were comped on their number of SDRs hitting quota, that would be a pretty interesting idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I said it. The discussion you'd have in management levels and executive levels about how we set quotas would change dramatically. And because there's such a disconnect between the quota and actual attainment, then it's lost all value.
Right.
It's lost value. So do something different. And that's just, one idea I have about doing different is, make them personally responsible for the number of the reps that hit quota. Yeah. You'd find quotas get much more reasonable all of a sudden. It wouldn't affect the overall number the company produces in a negative way. It'd probably increase the attainment. Right before the pandemic, I spoke to CEOs that were of a portfolio of a private equity company and asked this question. I said, so who's going to raise quotas in this room? And most of them.
Every hand in the air, I guarantee it, right?
Yeah. So we sort of talked about it and it seemed like the average would be like 15% or something like that. I said, so let me ask you this question. So how many of you have invested sufficiently this year to increase your people's capabilities by 15%? Nobody. Yeah. It's like, well, come on. This is really simple, right? I mean, if you have a machine tool that has a certain capacity, right? Are you going to make it do 20% more than its rated capacity, or are you going to go buy a new machine tool that has that capacity? You got to do something. Yeah. When it comes to sales, and it's just this not enough attention paid to it from a really thoughtful perspective.
Interesting too, because in that room, I imagine none of those same leaders could look down the hallway at marketing and ask them like, hey, when are 15% more leads coming down the pipe?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, we're stuck in these bad behaviors and they just, keep perpetuating them. And when I said early on, we could just stop a lot of them and be no worse off and probably be better off in many respects.
So I'm curious, when you apply kind of sell without selling out to the top of the funnel, how you think about kind of the prospecting motion in this light? I'm sure there's like probably 46 different prospecting behaviors that we could define as salesy that could stop tomorrow and we'd all be the better for it. But
I think it's a learning. I think it's a learning thing. Right. I mean, I think that if we started at the bottom and said, look, we're going to commit to increasing win rates. So that's going to have an impact ultimately on the quantity and quality of what we produce from marketing at the top of the funnel. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a loop where you're getting feedback, continual feedback, and saying, look, we're getting feedback from sales that, hey, qualified opportunities with these attributes, specific attributes, if we execute in a certain way, we're going to win a higher fraction of them. And we're going to reinforce that by not just by our win rate, but reinforce that by actually going out and talking to the buyers and saying, what was your experience like with our sellers? And I'm talking about win-loss analysis, because that tends to focus so much on, you know, price and product and so on. No, what was your experience like with the seller in this motion, in this deal, both win and lose? Now we've got another data point to say, to bring back to say, okay, we need certain attributes in our prospects. We need certain attributes in our sellers to help the buyers make a decision. And this is such a missing piece of information that I talk to sales leaders and they're, you know, hiring and they're writing job descriptions about what they need and, you know, closers and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, let me just ask you a question. Have you ever asked your buyers what they need from your sellers? And the answer is always no. Well, isn't that the whole point? I mean, you ever had a buyer say, Andy, could you hire a closer for me, please? I need somebody to come close me. Or as I say in the book, is yeah, never ever were buyers say, hey, Eric, love your product, love your service, you know, but I just can't buy from you because you're not salesy enough. Could you be more salesy? Never is going to happen.
Said no buyer ever.
No buyer ever. Could you be more salesy? So let's make that the priority for us when we're out hiring people, is let's get people that are really salesy, because that's what we want. And let's train them to be even more salesy.
One of the most salesy things I can think of is the term objection handling.
Ooh.
I know, it's a jump scare. It literally, like, I think that's of that term.
How much time do we have?
And much as you need.
Yeah, it's such a salesy thing to think about objections as something you need to overcome, right?
Well, let's just start with the word, right? Yeah. First of all, a buyer rarely objects to anything, right? It's not like, you know, Law and Order. Your Honor, I object. It's like, no, no one objects, right? I've had, in my career, maybe one time a customer really objected. And as in the midst of negotiating with, not get too off track, but it's a great story. It's, you know, in the midst of negotiating this pretty big deal with this Fortune 100 company for this revolutionary type of satellite communications network. And I was working for a startup and I'd been dealing with the senior VP of this company's publicly traded company for like 2 days. I get a call at the end of the second day from home office. They're saying, say, how are negotiations going? I said, no, pretty good. I think we're tomorrow will be the day where we're done. Oh, good. Well, we've got some bad news. I said, oh, really? What's that? Well, we made an error in the spreadsheet in our cost calculations, and we're going to have to raise prices. I was like, okay, how much? And it's like, well, about 50%. I said, here I am. We're about ready to walk, sign the contract. 50%? And yeah, they had made a mistake. I talked to the CEO. It's like, so I had to go back into this office of the senior VP of this Fortune 100 company and tell them that, yeah, I wasn't baiting and switching him. I had to raise his price by 50. So as security walked me out of the building, he had an objection.
Order in the court.
Yeah, order in the court is right. I did go back and get the deal the next day, but that was only because of the relationship I had with him. He knew I was not screwing with him. He knew this was a real thing because of the connection we had. Anyway, yeah, the objections is, think about the word. So no one objects to it, right? But when we put that label on it, it's like we think words don't matter. If somebody has an objection, then suddenly we become adversaries, right? This becomes adversarial. It's a price objection. Well, it's not a price objection. They have a question about your pricing. Objections are questions. Unless you, the scenario I described, then they're just objecting. But yeah, the question. So let's, what's the question behind that? But we train salespeople to, you know, have these, you know, fumbling logic ways to handle. I mean, so my first training class, I talked a little bit about in the book, first sales training class, their way to handle objections, videos of this sales trainer we saw, this horrible guy, was, well, just suppose that wasn't a problem, right? And that was the way of handling it. We don't like your price. Well, just suppose you didn't like our price. Then would you want to buy our product? Or, or, you know, we only make the product in red, but the prospect wants it in blue. Well, just suppose we could make it in blue. Would you buy our car?
You can have any color you want, as long as it's black.
Right. We only make it in red. I mean, it's that type of, and this stuff still goes on today. It's like just mindless. So it's just a question. Find out what the question is. Use your questions to find out what the buyer is confused about or what they have concerns about. That's what an objection is. They have a question. Find out what the question is, and then you can answer it. Don't assume.
Well, I think a lot of times, especially at the top of the funnel, if you're, you know, kind of off into SDR land, and you know, the phone's the easiest channel to see this on. What I oftentimes refer to, rather than calling it objection handling, I even use this word deliberately with our own team and our own SDRs, because I think they should think properly about this. Mm-hmm. And I say, what you've really got there is conditioned response.
Right.
You know, like ultimately people are telling you not interested, or some very close cousin of that.
Right.
Largely because they don't even want to listen. You haven't poked or provoked interest or relevancy right. on behalf of that person. And so they gave you a conditioned response.
Right. But sometimes not interested means not interested.
Yeah.
And somebody commented on one of my posts last week about this. And there's a guy who said, I'm avoiding salespeople like the plague. And he went through this list of things. Yeah. Not prepared. I mean, there's like six or seven things, and they all demonstrate selling out behavior.
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah, we can do better. I mean, I'm a business owner. Yeah, if I tell somebody I'm not interested, I'm generally not interested. Sometimes, yeah, sure. There's a way they can approach that, though. Okay, so timing's not right. And then there's, you know, I've written about this, a little questioning tree you go through about. Yeah. Would you be open to receiving information about them, thus and such? Well, that's not really important. Well, yeah. You can sort of work your way through a tree to say, okay, here's something I can send you. They'd be open to receiving. Fine. Let's do that. But instead it's push, 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 push. And I always remember this one comment on a LinkedIn post I made probably 5-6 years ago where I talked about, you know, sometimes no just means no. This one guy says, he said, that's such BS. He says, when you get no, that's when it's time to start selling. And I'm like, okay, there's the problem.
But you know, all no's are created equal.
Oh yeah, all no's are created equal, right? Well, but and we sort of lean into that, right? And the way we sort of, again, socialize our salespeople, say, look, there's not a ding in marketing, but say, okay, you know, we've got our ICP, we've got certain personas we talk to, and the personas are starting to, yeah, we're going to ask these questions, these personas, because the answers are going to be sort of like this. And people come so regimented, it's like when it's, if there's nuance, they can't handle the nuance. And that's really, you know, I think it's so important. I talk about in the book is, I don't want every SDR to be just like every other SDR. I mean, I don't want Eric to be like Caroline, because they look at the world differently. They ask questions differently. They receive information differently. So yeah, I think, I love conversational intelligence tools to help people get better, but they should be used to help people, the individual, get better and become the best version of themselves, not to turn Eric into a clone of Caroline. And that's sort of the lazy way that the technology is used.
Yeah. And by that right, you know, I'm curious what your thoughts are about scripts for SDRs. You know, scripts versus roadmaps or, you know, sets of good questions. Like what do you think? And what do you notice nowadays, you know, with how the trends are going? Are scripts becoming more useful or less useful? And what are some good alternatives?
Well, I think it sort of depends how they're applied, right? is if it's said, hey, this is the roadmap and the framework. And then I think that's more positive than saying, yes, you must ask these questions. Because, you know, you hear recordings where the rep will ask a question and there'll be this pause when they get the answer. And they're not listening. What they're doing is noting that they got the answer and then scrolling down to the next question. Where the what the buyer has done is said, well, they've sort of opened the door and said, ask me a follow-up question. Ask me something a little bit deeper about this. Well, that can be problematic because we don't necessarily enable our SDRs to have those deeper conversations, right? Which is sort of the weakness of the process for many companies, is especially if you're selling something more complex, is you put your least knowledgeable people at the point of attack and expect them to have productive conversations where, you know, it's really sort of unfair. I mean, I think personally, what I think you should do is SDRs should be involved in the full cycle somehow as a partner to it and so on. So they can see throughout the entire process, begin to understand what's really important to the buyers firsthand so they can start integrating that back into the conversations they have up front. But without that insight, it becomes, they're just, to use an indelicate term, we just treat them like cannon fodder. Right? Ask these questions, book, you know, make these calls and so on. And that's not, I think, what we want. We want people that, you know, have a better opportunity of engaging and asking a serious question and understanding what it is they're talking about and why it's important, could be important to the buyer. So they need more exposure through the full cycle. And you see some companies that do that, you know, partner their SDRs with AEs more effectively than others, and they get that transfer of information or they get them involved. But in a lot of cases, you know, you've got, now on the virtual sales floor, is you've got, you know, people just banging out calls and thinking they're, you know, trying to do a good job, but we're not giving them the support they need.
It's funny too, in that exact scenario, you don't need an exhaustive or an every sales cycle type of feedback loop where the SDR is part of it to really get the hang of what's going on behind my part of the show, so to speak. It's actually very little when you're a passenger and you have a vested interest. Oftentimes it's, I like to say that the first few appointments that any SDR sets should be the ones that they follow all the way down the rabbit hole, right? So that they can understand, you know, what's behind them.
Yep. Yeah. And then they get that experience. I'm a big advocate that, you know, SDRs should be in their 40s and 50s. You know, get people with more life experience and more experience in business. And you would then have people who are better able to handle that job, right? Because it's a tough job. And that was part of sales I hated, right? And I, my first 2 years in sales where I was out making 30, 40 cold calls in the field. Well, the first year, most every day, but after that, less regularly. But it's like, yeah, I mean, I did it just so I could get over it and get to the part that was fun. Well, there are some people who think that part is really fun and engaging. And I think they tend to have a different demographic than those people we're typically hiring into that role. And they're more comfortable in their own skins. They've got more lived experience and more business experience, perhaps, and more acumen. And so it's not like we're not paying SDRs a good amount of money, right? I mean, I know a lot of people that have been in sales for a long time think that's, you know, depending on the company, that making six figures or more, not a bad deal.
Interesting. Yeah. No, and I'm curious too, kind of walking back to something that we were talking about earlier, inbound, you know, making sure that we're more selective at the top. And I'm curious what you think some of the differentiators in skill are between inbound and outbound and how to select, you know, candidates for those skills. Because I think a lot of people think that the same sales rep could do inbound and outbound just effectively. Right. And a lot of organizations have reps doing both inbound and outbound and not really training on, you know, much of a difference there. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know if there is a huge difference in skill set between the two. I mean, I think one is, you know, willingness to do the job, right? I mean, I think for people that aren't willing to make the calls, then sure, they can have a role responding to inbound. Obviously, we've got people working on inbound, is they've got to be willing to actually be responsive. And you'd think that would be second nature or a primary requirement. But I was just looking at a study that Chili Piper did about response times on leads, inbound leads. And still across the board, and they were talking to SaaS companies, about 10 different categories of SaaS companies, but across the board, still about 30% of inbound leads never get followed up. This is across companies of all sizes. And actually, it's worse among bigger companies, right?
My head is exploding listening to this.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it's crazy. And a very small percentage that respond quickly, let's say within 5 minutes. But that's just a matter of process and priority.
Yeah.
I had a client years ago that was beautiful inbound lead flow. And the guy was just a master at creating it, the CEO and the marketing person. But the leads weren't getting followed up. And so I came in as my, consultant hat, very smart person. And I said, well, I know how to fix this problem. And what was that? And I said, this was a smaller company, only like 6 sellers at the time. I said to CEO, I said, what you do is you're going to open up Salesforce at 4:30 every afternoon, make sure all the leads that came in that day were followed up. Oh, okay. Boom. Problem solved. if someone looks, that's really the problem with lead follow-up is really somebody looking and caring. It has to be somebody's job to ensure that it happens. Because you ask most CEOs, this is by my experience from my consulting, is they just assume it's happening.
Yeah.
And then you go down to the next level and maybe it's CRO or VP of sales. Yeah, they think it's happening too. And suddenly it's one of these things where it's like nobody's job to check to make sure it really is happening. And when you enforce it, shocking, 100% of the leads get followed up. Now, they're not all good leads, but I challenge most salespeople to assess accurately before actually talking to someone, whether it's a good lead or not. Unless it comes from like a college student overseas, right? Then you can sort of discount that one. But if it's from a company, you're investing the money. Why flushing 30% of your marketing spend down the drain? Because no one will follow up. So it can be easily enforced if companies want to do that. And then it's like, okay, who's actually responding? If somebody responding that knows what they're talking about. So again, with this same client, is I swapped out the several members of the inside team and brought people in from engineering. Because it's kind of a technical product we were selling. And so in the first 30 minutes, and everybody had to be called back within 30 minutes. That was our standard. And usually within the first 30 minutes of the call, we had a live prospect because the engineers knew exactly what they're talking about. They understood the problems of the people they were talking to. They had the acumen to deal with it. And sort of our capper was, because there's a software element when everybody always invariably wanted a demo, is after 30 minutes, the customer would say, can we schedule a demo? And what I did is I trained the sellers to say, nope, but we can do one right now. Here's the link. So within an hour, we had taken people quite a ways down the funnel and had a very high win rate, needless to say, on this. So if you set up the process with the right people, this can be done much more effectively. And I'm a huge believer that, inbound is better. I know it's shocking because there's all sorts of salespeople say the only good lead is one I developed myself. I don't think there's any statistics that prove that a proactively developed outbound lead, there's lots of people claim there are. I don't think there are. Close at a higher rate, have higher ACV, any of these metrics that people claim. That's not true.
That said, I think the one commercial that I would say for outbound is, and this is coming from a guy who's invented inbound programs that have generated, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of leads over the years. You can design programs till you're blue in the face, but getting the right customer to walk through your front door is a super challenging problem.
Oh, absolutely.
And the only effective solution is outbound, period, full stop.
Well, you can be more targeted, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, I was talking to a CEO a couple of years ago. It's like, they started doing the usual SaaS stuff, starting small companies, SMB and moving up. And he said, what's the secret to selling large enterprises? I said, picking up the phone and calling them. I mean, it's pretty simple. You want to sell to big accounts? Pick up the phone, call big accounts.
And your enterprise game plan.
Yeah. You can make it a lot more complicated than that, but you know who they are.
Yeah.
Call them. I mean, it's obviously oversimplifying a little bit, but it's not that much more difficult.
Right.
To get started. So yeah, I agree. You can be much more targeted with Outbound, but you know, it's, you got to get people to be willing to go do that.
Yeah. I'm taking it back a little to, you know, SDR craft and, you know, getting on those phones. Active listening, I think, is probably one of the hardest things that you can teach someone. In fact, it's, I think, damn near impossible to teach someone how to listen, right? Like it's one of those things, but you have to, I mean, you have to, because that's one of the foundations of a good salesperson.
Right.
How do you approach active listening?
Yeah, I hate the term. So I think what we just want to focus people on is listening to understand versus listening to respond.
Yes. So
draw that distinction. And the way that I recommend, one recommendation I have in the book is because, you know, you got people a little bit newer, they're a little anxious, so make sure they're doing a good job, all those things, is you got to build a pause into your listening. You ask a question, somebody responds. If anybody's played touch football, is what I recommend is you say to yourself, one Mississippi, before you respond. Take a breath, take a count. Now, don't say one Mississippi out loud. People might be wondering what you're doing, but say it to yourself and give yourself a chance to process what you just heard, right? Then ask a follow-up question. It doesn't take long to listen, process it, see if you got the context. If you don't, formulate what question. You can do that all in, you know, 250 milliseconds. So give yourself that break. And if you do that, you get a little bit of a pattern going where you're pausing, you're being thoughtful, you're being deliberate. Buyer senses it as well. Yeah, just build the pause in.
You feel that people don't do that because they're afraid of silence?
Well, I think partly, yeah. Especially when you're newer, you're, you know, less secure in what you're doing. That's why I advocate hiring older SDRs that are more comfortable in their skins and so on. Because, yeah, I think they'd have more productive conversations. There's other ways we can train new people to come up into sales than just being SDRs. So yeah, you know, I think that everybody's a little afraid of the silence, the gaps.
That's so interesting. It's like that scene from the movie. I feel like I'm about to embarrass myself for not knowing what the movie is, but he says, everyone's afraid of silence. Or she says, everyone's afraid of silence. No one just wants to sit there with each other anymore and have a moment of silence. Mm. You guys must know what movie I'm talking about. It's very famous.
No, you got me too.
Keeping me.
Yeah, I'll look it up as soon as we hang up. But
yeah, I was just playing the tape that said The Sound of Silence, and all I could hear was Simon and Garfunkel.
Garfunkel singing, yeah. See, here we have a moment of silence.
There we go. A comfortable moment of silence. So many people are afraid of that, but
that's right. Well, especially podcasters. It doesn't make good radio.
That said, they used to, back in the 30s, I want to say that there was always those moments of silence where the cliffhanger would be put in, right? Like most radio shows were built around that concept. Yeah,
well, they're serialized, right?
Yeah.
Episode to episode. Hey, works in sales too, right? Have a little bit of cliffhanger at the end of all your sales calls.
Yeah, and I think that moment of silence kind of helps too. You know, if you're employing techniques like labeling or mirroring, you can't employ those techniques without actually listening and knowing what you're labeling or knowing what you're mirroring, right? So the silence is your best friend. It's, you need it.
Yeah, well, it gives you a chance to process, right? That's really the whole point of suggesting it.
I think it also helps with the thing you mentioned earlier. You mentioned, you know, in Cialdini's persuasion book that people like when other people like them.
Right.
When you pause and you're deliberate, a lot of times the label that gets attached to you is considered.
Yeah. Well, it's just be yourself. I mean, that's the hardest thing for new people in sales is well, not new people, lots of people in sales. Just be yourself as much as you can. Be yourself. And if you're, you know, if you are maybe a little more hyper, you know, you're going to really focus on that pause a little bit, but fine, do that. But then don't suppress the rest of your energy, because that could be, that's you, and people will connect with you because based on that.
That's really the fundamental underlying thesis statement of sell without selling out. So we've actually come kind of like full circle, mm-hmm. if you will, in this podcast. Andy, do us a favor and let the listeners know where they can get in touch with you, or
sure.
You know, obviously your book's for sale on Amazon. You can get the audiobook, you can get the paperback, it's all available.
If you enjoy the sound of my voice, get the audiobook, because I'm the one narrating it. If you don't like, then you're probably not listening to my podcast. Yeah, buy the book at Amazon, connect with me on LinkedIn, very active on LinkedIn. And you connect, yeah, message me if you want to connect. Go to my website, andypaul.com. Listen to my podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul. We've just hit 1,040 episodes, excuse me.
Love it. Well, this has been a great, great, great discussion, Andy.
That's been fun. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And wisdom.
Yeah. It was so nice meeting you. Thank you so much for hopping on. This was awesome.
Yeah, Caroline, nice to meet you as well.
And thank you for your silence.
It's Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is the movie I'm thinking about.
Oh, really?
And there's a diner, yeah. And she says to him, everyone's afraid of silence.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. I don't sit there anymore, yeah.
Isn't that so funny? Because I can remember so many other iconic parts of Pulp Fiction.
Except that, and that's the one I remember.
Yeah,
I
okay.
Royale with cheese. My favorite is the Henry Keitel character.
Yeah, the what they call him? The cleaner, not the...
Fixer. I fix problems.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anywho.
All right.
Love it. Thanks again, Andy.
Thank you.